Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And just let me know. You can contact me or you can start your own prayer circle if you would really like to seek, I'll just say, the divine hand of Providence's involvement in this process. I feel bad that I didn't think about it myself. But anywho, there's no reason why we shouldn't be seeking his help. Benjamin Franklin was one that brought that up in the Constitutional Convention. Anyway, don't forget that the debt is fraud, and we are diving into Article 2 so we can kind of cover through this or get through this pretty quickly. But what we're going to have to do, because the very front end, we got Tammy back. Welcome back, Tammy.
Hello. Thank you.
And so right up front, we're going to have to deal with the 12th Amendment and Article 2, because the 12th Amendment changes the language of the 12th Amendment. As a matter of fact, in your Article 2, Section 1, see all of that is in italicized?
I don't see italicized.
Okay, so if you look at the third paragraph down in Section 1.
Oh, okay.
It starts off with the electors. So that's all italicized. So technically what I did with the color-coded Constitution is I highlighted the part that the 12th Amendment changed. So when we hit that part, we'll read through that, and then we'll read through the 12th Amendment. That way, we'll test you on on what nuances changed in that language. In other words, that's a huge paragraph. And the 12th Amendment is kind of a large paragraph, too. But there's very slight changes in this. And so I think it'll be a good opportunity to kind of go through both. So anyway, and I do this all the time, because when we talk about the Electoral College, this is how it's supposed to happen. We do not follow the Constitution today. So anyway, with Section 1, the very first part is a power. In other words, this is where a delegation of power is provided. And go ahead and just read that very first paragraph.
Okay, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and together with the vice president chosen for the same term be elected as follows.
Okay, and this is how they're to be elected, and they say elected, but this is how they're to be chosen, because there's really no election process. It's a double election. In other words, we choose the electors, and then the electors choose the president. So that's why they actually use chosen quite a bit here. So anyway, go ahead. The very first part. Go ahead.
Yeah, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. But no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector.
Okay, so those are kind of the requirements that are unique nuances to an elector. And actually, that's already up in Article 1. When they talk about the representatives, they also mention the electors, and that the standard of the electors or qualifications are the same as a representative. You have to be 25 years of age, have to be a citizen, so forth. So anyway, so they kind of lay out, okay, now we're going to go into the process, okay? So when we, the people, have gone to the ballot and we have elected our electors, there's no presidential name on the ballot. You vote for who you want as the elector, okay? That's how it's supposed to happen. So go ahead and read the italicized, And then when you get to a point like a semicolon, we can stop and look at what they're doing. Because
the vote for who we want to be elector is supposed to be a popular vote?
Yes. So in other words, if you look at why counties matter most, I broke down how electors were chosen from the very beginning, the very first selection of the president, up until 1856. 1856 is when the states basically abandoned the Constitution and the Electoral College because they stabilized a two-party system. Because what was happening was one party would become destabilized and it would transform into the Whigs or transform into another party. Now, the Democrats, when the Democratic Party came, you know, established itself in the early 1820s, mid-1820s, so that Andrew Jackson would unseat John Quincy Adams. That was done by Martin Van Buren, and they created a dominance. This was big government dominance. And so they, as you look at all of the other parties that contested the Democratic election, or I should say, because the Democrats became the next major party. After the Republicans created a monopoly on the party from Thomas Jefferson through James Monroe and into John Quincy Adams, the Democrats, instead of the Federalists or the Federalists, they changed their name to the Democrats. Oh, well, now we got a new name and everybody will now vote for them because they're different. They have a different name. And so this is how stupid we are. But anyway, so the Democrats maintained a long run of successions of success from the Andrew Jackson into the Civil War and even beyond. So the Democratic Party had not changed, but what was changing was the Republican Party. When they stabilized in 1856, this new Republican Party came back. And then they wanted to do was they wanted to differentiate between Jefferson and Madison's Republican Party that they created to this new Republican Party that was more of a big government, and they were okay with compromising the Constitution. Prior to that, no, we lived within the Constitution. In other words, they were far more purists back in Thomas Jefferson's day. So in 1856, the parties basically abandoned the Electoral College, and what they did was the parties chose in their conventions, they chose who their elector would be, the party did, and then the people would vote for president. And so based on whomever won the presidency, those states would then send who the party selected off so that it would guarantee that they would get their candidate in. In other words, it was a way they could control the outcome. So,
yeah, because that's what we do in Wyoming. We
yeah, I know.
We elect delegates that go to the state convention, and then the delegates at the state convention choose the electors.
Well, so actually, I believe at your state convention, you already chose your electors. I believe you chose them. Like the last time I was there, I know Carl Allred was one of those that was chosen. And because of that, I think he ended up serving as Secretary of State. So, in other words, when you get this honor of becoming an elector, it kind of puts a spotlight on you. Wow, that guy's well-respected, because how many electors are there in the state of Wyoming? Only three.
Three.
So anyway, the people are supposed to choose their electors. That's why we set up top in that pink part. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature may direct. In other words, they're supposed to appoint, the legislature is supposed to appoint the manner in how we're to choose, how we are to choose our electors. Does it say anywhere that they will determine the outcome for the people? No.
Mm-mm.
So the manner would be, are they going to vote by, oral? They, you know, they're going to, you know, cast their vote orally. You know, the sheriff will have a big meeting and, okay, who do you vote for? And they provide names. So you could do it orally and they would just write it down, because you got to remember, way back then, most people couldn't write.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes they did it orally. Sometimes, you know, you would come up and they would ask you, or you could write it down or what have you. But in a lot of cases, it wasn't done with, you know, educated people. They just needed to be able to pay their poll tax. They may not have been able to write everything. So there were the manner in how the people were to choose their electors was left to the state legislature. Now, if you go on, a number of electors equal to the whole number. So the rest of that part basically says, well, this is based, your electors is based upon your senators and your representatives. So you're only going to get three in Wyoming. And then they basically say that the electors cannot be in office in any way of office trust, you know, as a public servant, period. They have to be unfettered and not in office, period. This next part is now what the electors do. Now that we've chosen the electors, what are they supposed to do? And how do they choose the president? That's why this big paragraph basically states how the electors are to choose the president, not we the people. Okay? Because nobody knows where the ballots have been cast yet. All we've done is we've selected an elector, and the elector basically is now going to decide who he's going to vote for president, who he's going to vote for vice president, because there wasn't tickets. In other words, when you looked at all of the candidates were candidates for the president. Nobody ran for vice president. You see my point?
Mm-hmm.
So when the electors meet, they actually are to decide who would be the best vice president to serve who they chose to be president. And in many cases, they have chosen contrast, and Lincoln was a good case in point. Now, that was, I won't say it was a contrast, but what the Republican Party did was they basically appealed to Andrew Johnson, who was a Democrat, and they appealed to him to become a part of the Republican ticket, so that there was this gesture to the Southern slave owner Democrats that, hey, you know, we've got a guy on this ticket.
Anyway, yeah.
And he was a Southerner. So anyway, go ahead and let's read from this to the first point where you think, okay, this is a good point, like a semicolon, period, or what have you. Go ahead. You decide when to take the pause so we can look at what's supposed to happen.
Okay. The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves.
Okay. So here's the question. Does that mean that the president and the vice president cannot come from the same state?
Say no. Well, let's see.
The electors are to choose two people of whom are at least shall not be the inhabitant of one of whom shall not be.
They had to be different states. Yeah.
So the electors of each state are to make sure that they choose one person. And if they want one person from their state, they can't have the second person from their state. They can only have one. They have to choose. And, you know, I would guess that their preference would be the president would, you know, they're choosing the president from their state. And why would they choose, you know, their person to be second? But here's the thing. That doesn't mean that the president and the vice president can't actually be selected and come from the same state. What happens is, you can't, let's just say a good example, President Trump, because this was a possibility, Trump and the Governor Santos both come from Florida, right? Mm-hmm. The only state that cannot vote for both of them would be Florida. All the other states, because now all the other electors can all choose two candidates from another state. They just can't come. They can't choose two from their own state. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because take one from their state and one from the other. Another. Yeah,
you hear all the time people telling you, oh, well, you can't have a president and a vice president from the same state. And that is mythology. It was only implied here that the elector could not choose two people from their state.
Gotcha.
Okay. All right. So go ahead.
And they shall make a list of all the persons voted for and of the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of the government of the United States, directed to the president of the Senate. Yeah, directed to the president of the Senate.
Okay, so what they just did was they're going to choose and they're going to make a list of who was selected for president. And who was selected for vice president, the full list, and how many each person got from each, or each candidate got votes for. In other words, Washington got eight, Jefferson got one for president, and John Adams got one. And so then they would go into Thomas Jefferson got for vice president got four, John Adams got six, and Washington got one. You know, so they would create these lists, they would certify them, and then they would send them off. And then what they would do is they would take the entire list and mix them all together so that they would add everybody's name up to find out if there was any candidate that had a clear majority. That candidate would win, would become the president based on how the electors chose the president. Does that make sense?
So it wasn't just choosing between two people.
Well, so right. Everybody that was eligible was game. They could have been, they weren't, the electors' hands were not tied. And as a matter of fact, nine times out of ten, the electors were really, you know, more of a, you know, a wise sage type of person that would understand, you know, all of a sudden during the campaign and everything else, maybe somebody caught a death of cold and died. Now they had to choose somebody else, but they were the ones chosen to make the decision. So however things panned out, you know, as the, let's say the possible field of candidates might have changed or information may have changed to where, oh, you know what, I'm not going to vote for that guy. He, you know, all of a sudden it came out that he had a, you know, committed adultery or something. I won't do that. So I'm going to cast my vote for the other guy. So they had all the latitude in the world of who they were going to choose. What the way they campaigned, though, they campaigned that, you know, they were the representative for Madison, and that was, you know, that was their job. So as you look through all of the different, and I'll just say all of the different races, because some of the electoral college, some of the states actually let everybody vote at large. So if you had 13 seats, you had 13 electors and they were all elected at large, there would be a huge ticket for each seat. In other words, you'd have, you know, 20 or 40 tickets, and then you would choose by name which one you would want for this ticket, this ticket, this ticket, and whoever you selected would go into that. So it was really kind of a quagmire of how they did it, because there was just an open field, and they didn't actually run a candidacy for a seat. It was an at-large election. Does that make sense? So then they would fill the seats. With the first seat that gets filled is the electors who got the most votes. And then they would down select down and down and down. And whoever had the least votes, for that last seat, or I should say whoever had the most remaining would get the last seat.
So all of them were up for election for any of the seats?
All of the electors, that's the way they did it, yes. By 1822.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
By 1822, all of the electors would be, you know, they were all being selected at large. There was only one state, South Carolina, that refused to give the people, give their people, the ability to choose their electors. The state legislature chose the electors, which was an outright violation of the Constitution because they weren't to have the control of the outcome. They were only have to, they only controlled the manner in how we choose to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So as we go through this a little further, we're seeing that, you know, now you have this, you know, body of electors, and they created these lists, they certify them, and now they send them off so that it goes to the president of the Senate. So the next line is, the president of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate.
Yeah, so the president of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the president, if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, and if there be more than one who have such majority and have an equal number of votes, then the House of Representatives shall immediately choose by ballot one of them for president.
Okay, so they went through this down select, down select, down select until they could get the president. But if not, then it would go to the House of Representatives. Well, in 1800, it was not easy. I think they've tried 60 times to actually, you know, cast votes. And I believe that was actually done by the House of Representatives because they were all voting on one ticket, two names. In other words, when you put two names on a ticket, though both of those names were for president. They were not choosing the president. The person that got the second most votes became president in the original process. So this is what we're kind of peeling here. As we peel the onion, we're getting into the layers of what are they really doing. They're choosing the president first, and then they choose the vice president by the second most names, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so keep going.
And if no person have a majority, then from the five highest on the list, the said house shall in like manner choose the president.
Yes.
But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from two-thirds of the states. And the majority of all the states shall be necessary to a choice.
Okay, so the other thing that most people don't know or don't understand is the Electoral College really only has just one shot. I mean, they send their votes and it goes into Congress. And they say, okay, this is how the playing field is shaped. Based on that shaping, because remember, if they can't come up with a clear choice, then it goes to the House of Representatives. And then the House of Representatives, with five choices, boils it down by vote. Now, in 1800, it took 60 casts of ballots to finally get Thomas Jefferson the presidency. So, and it was Aaron Burr as the vice president. Again, both, they had to put two names on each ballot for president. There was a big, what, and you'll see what the difference is with the 12th Amendment. So keep going. Read the last of it.
In every case, after the choice of the president, the person having the greatest number of votes of the electors shall be the vice president.
There you go. See, so whoever wins the beauty contest becomes the president, and whoever's the runner-up becomes the vice president. Okay, and now we're going to be going into a break. So if you hold on, we will then dive into the 12th Amendment, and we will let everybody kind of see the nuances. Even though there's a lot of words there, there's just some real nuances of change, and they simplified it dramatically. We'll be right back after this one promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so welcome back. And Tammy, don't forget to unmute yourself. But here we go. Now we're going to dive into the 12th Amendment. And so go ahead and go down to the 12th Amendment. It's underneath the Bill of Rights, bunch of all of these things going from the 11th Amendment down to the 12th Amendment. You got it?
Yep.
Okay. Now, again, the electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president. One of whom, now, you know, I'm going to go ahead and read it, and you tell me if you can dissect the difference. One of whom, at least, shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. That sounds the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They shall name in their ballots the person voted for as president, and in distinct ballots, in other words, two, the person voted for vice president, and they shall make distinct lists of all persons voted for as president and all persons voted for as vice president.
Okay, so they separated the president and vice president.
At that point. So in other words, they, at the state level, the electors would choose who they wanted for president and who they wanted for vice president. This would force a down select because everybody's name on the ballots were presidents. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in other words, as it went to the president of the Senate, they got a big list of presidents, and then they were going to count, and whoever won, who got the most names became president, whoever got the second most became vice president. Mm-hmm. That's how it was originally designed. Now, the electors are the ones at the state level where they would start differentiating. So you'd probably notice that there was, you know, certain people that didn't even come close, you know, and weren't even listed on the presidency, but they were listed on the vice presidency. So, in other words, they get locked between the two. Now, when we look at how it moves forward, then it goes to the Senate, right? But let me keep moving on. voted for as vice president, the numbers voted for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States directed to the president of the Senate. Sounds the same there, so there's no real change. The president of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the president if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, which means that you have to have 50% plus one of the entire field of electors. So if there is 540, then you have to have at least 270 to win.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and that's what it is today. And if no person have such majority, then from the persons having the highest numbers, not exceeding three on the list of those voted for president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president. In choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states. In other words, they're voting in quorum. In other words, each state gets one vote. And I think they even spell it out here. The representation of each state having one vote. So in other words, California gets one vote. Wyoming gets one vote. When it comes down to choosing the president in the House of Representatives, each state gets one vote. And they're basically taking, supposedly, they're taking the three top names. Got to remember that today, if we really look at this, does that mean that, you know, a person that may have gotten one or two electors, right? Because pretty much it's going to be whatever the Democrat and Republican is. But there may be another party that actually might make it to that list, right? Because one state may actually have one vote. So that name has to go forward into this. But you see the whole point. The parties have made it impossible for another party to ever get selected.
Right.
Because that it'll go into the House, and the House, based on party, will vote. And it came down to, if this was exercised the way it should have been exercised in 2020, because the House of Representatives should have chosen, because the Electoral College could not choose the president. They didn't have quorum. This goes down to the lawsuit and everything else we were doing, where the only legitimate electors, the only ballots that were legitimate that came up from the states was 131. There was no way they could have reached the 270 needed for anybody to become president. No way. Even if Biden got all of them, it would have been 131. So what would have had to happen is that they would have had to go into chambers with Biden and Trump and whatever third party, because that's what they're saying here. And then the House of Representatives shall cast one vote for the president. And there you go. And that's it. So what would have happened in 2020 had Congress done their job? And now, just so you know, out of the legislative party control in 2020, there were 30 states that were controlled by the Republicans and 20 states controlled by the Democrats. So there's a good likelihood that it would have been maybe 30 to 20. But we know that there were states like Wyoming where Cheney would have thrown her vote. Right. Mm-hmm. And there was a good possibility that Wyoming may have actually. Well, so there was only the one representative anyway. So Cheney would have thrown her vote, and that would have taken one, you know, knocked down. How many other states would have done the same thing that were Republican but still deep state rhinos? So anyway, so my point is that Trump still would have probably gotten elected. He would have had to have lost five Republican House seats, or I mean state votes. And that would have been pretty tough to do. Anyway, let me go on. And if no person have such a majority from the persons having the highest number, not exceeding three on the list of those voted for president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president. But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by the states, and the representation of each shall have one vote. I think I just reread that. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from 2/3 of the states. So in other words, they have to have 2/3 of the states present, enough people from the states present to do this. And a majority of all the states shall be necessary to a choice. And if the House of Representatives shall not choose a president whenever the right choice shall devolve upon them, before the 4th day of March next following, after the election. So this is when they seat the government, or they seat the president on the 4th day of March. Then the vice president shall act as president, as in the case of the death or other constitutional disability of the president. The reason they're doing this, just so everybody understands, the reason that this is being done is because now they actually have a president chosen by the House, and the Senate chooses the vice president. And so, you know, if the House can't come up with a president and the Senate comes up with a vice president, then the vice president shall be president until, you know, they actually they go through this. The person having the greatest number of votes as vice president shall be the vice president if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. And if no person have a majority, then from the two highest numbers on the list, the Senate shall choose the vice president. A quorum for the purpose shall consist of two-thirds of the whole number of the senators, and a majority of the whole number shall be necessary to the choice. But no person constitutionally eligible to the office of president shall be eligible to that of vice president of the United States. So that means Kamala Harris could never have become vice president. She never could have been, nor should have been. Because right there, the vice president is also listed that they have to meet the same qualifications. She must be naturally born. So that's what would have happened had they followed the 2020 election. Now, going back up to Article 2, Section 1, and we kind of cleared out all of what we see in the italicized. Now we get back to the, you know, the gray and black stuff. Go ahead and pick it up from there.
The, okay. Hold on, I'm finding it.
It starts with the Congress may determine the time.
Okay, the Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States.
There you go. So Congress may, but if you read up above, it says each state shall. So the reason why Congress may, and this is the same language in Article 1, the reason why it says shall and may is if a state, because of an invasion, if a state, because, you know, some natural disaster, for whatever reason, the state legislature is just unable to, you know, establish an election, then Congress may do it for them. Okay? Mm-hmm. In other words, Congress does not trump the states. They may be able to do it if the states can't. That was how it was done, and that's how it was designed. In other words, what do you do if the state can't do it? Well, then Congress will have to do that. They'll have to choose the day, time, and all of that. So go ahead.
No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained to the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States.
Okay, so we actually have the details of what a natural-born citizen is qualified as in our petition for the natural-born citizen. It's petition 10. If you need that petition, folks, and you want to get this going where you live, then just give us, just give me a ring. Send me a phone. Well, my phone number's up on reclaimingtherepublic.org on the contact page, or you can send me an email. I want to get that so we can start getting these petitions to stop Kamala. You want to get people to start joining and creating a team. This is a great way because there's lots of people that really want to stop Kamala Harris from getting into that presidency because she's not eligible. We'll be in another constitutional crisis again because of another presidency. We were in a constitutional crisis with Obama. He was not a natural-born citizen. And we have another constitutional crisis because Biden was not constitutionally chosen. And so if Kamala Harris, this will be the third term going into 12 years of an illegitimate president operating out of the White House in the history of this nation. So in the italicized part, this has actually been changed with the 15th Amendment. And we'll wait till, or the 25th, we'll wait till we hit the 25th Amendment because this is regarding the removal. One of the things I think is important, folks, when you read the Constitution, And nine times out of ten, when you're holding a constitution in your hand, it may not tell you, most of them do not tell you, that these words you're reading right here have been changed by an amendment. The 11th Amendment changes Article 2. The 12th Amendment changes Article 1. The 25th Amendment changes Article 1 or Article 2. And so we've got all, you know, we've got all these different amendments out there that actually do make changes. So if you read this and then you move forward, you may forget that this following amendment actually changes something that you're reading. Because nine times out of ten, even though the 25th Amendment has been out there for years, that doesn't mean that when you're reading Article 2, Section 1, and you're reading this part right here, you won't think to actually go and say, hey, this was this part was replaced.
And
does that make sense how confusing this process is?
Yeah.
And this is all Roger Sherman's fault. Roger Sherman did not want to actually make the textual changes that were required by the amendment. James Madison said, no, we have to do that, which is one of the reasons why the amendment started off with articles, but because then they would have actually been tucked into the appropriate articles. But instead, Roger Sherman wanted to have all amendments listed at the end. And so, yeah, they didn't have computers. They couldn't even fathom cut and paste, right? So, you know, when people think, just forgive me for going down this rat hole, but when people think how brilliant these men were, they couldn't fathom the technology that's just common knowledge to everybody today. In other words, what was common knowledge to them was a lot different. And I believe the brain power of today is a lot more powerful than the brain power back in their day. Because, I mean, people only understood certain things. And today we get exposed by a lot more. There's a lot more bad information, which is why evil is just rampant, because it becomes very accessible. It becomes common knowledge. And next thing you know, people start doing evil things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like these Diddy parties that are going all over the place. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
I had to throw that in there. Anyway, let's move on. So let's read the next highlighted part. The president shall at stated times.
Okay. The president shall at stated times receive for his services a compensation which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected, and he shall not receive within that period any other emolument mm-hmm. from the United States or any of them.
Or any of the single states, correct. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Okay. This is the one point in time where they actually leave it a little ambiguous that he has to take this oath to support, preserve the ability, to the best of my ability, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Instead, in Article 6, you're going to find that it says that all people must be under oath or affirmation to support this Constitution, which means the original language Constitution, this Constitution, because if all of a sudden a different one is out there, then that's not the one that they're supposed to support. They're only supposed to support the original intent, the original language. Anyway, we'll dive into that when we get to Article 6. So now we're going into Article 2, Section 2. Go ahead.
The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states. When called into the actual service of the United States, he may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices and he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment.
Yeah. Okay. So, understanding that, you know, we've highlighted this reprieval or this reprieve and pardon, it has been abused, and there have been really bad characters that have been released or pardoned by bad presidents. And so, anyway, next paragraph.
He shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds
of the senators...
Let's stop
right there. Let's stop with the treaties. He shall have power by and with the advice. So, in other words, he has the ability to go and get a treaty. Does the Senate have the ability to go get a treaty?
No.
No. So, in other words, he's the only one that has the power to actually create and submit a treaty. So this is another power. He has the power of execution to execute the laws of the Union. That's it. And the power to be able to go and make, to treat with other nations and to create a treaty with them. But one of the things that they don't mention here that is in the Supremacy Clause, that he cannot go make a treaty with foreign nations with something that is not enumerated in the Constitution. That's why the Supremacy Clause says they can pass treaties that are under their authority. In other words, those treaties have to already be something under their authority.
Right.
In other words, let's just say we have this constitutional amendment that forbids the government from being able to abridge our right. So, in other words, they do not have this enumeration in the Constitution. They're actually kept from being able to create a treaty over the infringing upon our right to be able to bear arms at all. So if they go to the UN, they sign up with a treaty that they will start reducing arms in the nation and so forth. They can't do that. That is not under their authority. Does that make sense?
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Keep going.
Let's see.
You did the provided.
To make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur, and he shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law, but the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments.
So in other words, the president, when it gets down to really inconsequential positions, the president can go ahead and just appoint people for that. But for major positions, it will require the advice and consent of the Senate for those people to be able to be seated in this position. Go ahead, the last part of Section 2.
The president shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session.
Okay, so in other words, he's just filling vacancies where Obama actually just, instead of filling a vacancy that expires, he actually permanently put into positions of the court, and he got his, you know, his hand slapped. He should have been removed by the Supreme Court, but instead, they just slapped his hands. And so this really became a real problem when the Supreme Court and this whole nation allowed a president to serve that was not eligible to serve. In other words, violating the Constitution. Okay, so now we're going into Section 3, with the final section of Article 2. So this part right here, I'm going to guess, has something to do with possible impeachments or what have you, right? section three mm-hmm. or four. Go ahead.
He shall from time to time give the Congress information of the states of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment. He may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. He okay. shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all the officers of the United States.
Okay, so right here, in the very beginning of this, he says, and he shall from time to time give to Congress information of the State of the Union address, and recommend their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them, and in cases of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may. So in other words, if they can't come up with an agreement to adjourn, then he may, that shall, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. In other words, he can only adjourn them for the period of time that he thinks proper, but nothing exceeding their, in other words, what Lincoln did not have the power to adjourn and keep the Congress out of office. He has the power to may adjourn them as necessary, but not permanently. In other words, he can't basically say you can't come back into session. There's no power here. It's only the power to adjourn if they are in disagreement, because they are to basically agree to adjourn. Now, let me get to the front of this, though. The State of the Union is under his control. Did you see anything in Congress where Congress could control the State of the Union? In Article 1, in Article 1, was there anything regarding the State of the Union or the President addressing them?
No,
not at all. Remember Pelosi played with Trump and said, we're not going to hold the State of the Union. Remember she did that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And she had no power to do that. Trump could have actually just said, no, I'm going to do this. I'm coming over and I'm calling you into convening to basically, because he has, it's right here under the Constitution. He has the authority to basically give them what he believes are in certain measures, like he says, consideration, such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. So in other words, they don't have the control over his State of the Union. Somehow
it seems to be like, wouldn't he have had advisors that would have been able to say she can't do that?
Well, so over the course of how they've been doing it for years, they've been doing it that way, and nobody's been actually going, well, do they have the authority to do that? Well, nobody's ever had this problem. Well, we ran out of time, though, and I always have this problem. I always run out of time. So when we come back, we are going to hit Section 4, where we'll hit the impeachment process, or the what it'll take for impeachment, and then we'll get into Article 3, which is the judiciary, some more, hand-rubbing fun. Anyway, folks, I hope that you're learning. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.